Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. Yeah, we're back. It's been a while. I'm your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I am joined by Martin, totally cool dude, Willis.
Ah, oh, I was ready to laugh at something corny, but...
That was corny.
Oh, it was?
Totally cool dude? That's pretty corny.
Oh, well.
Anyway, but you were so touched, you overlooked the corniness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good.
Let me remove the tear from my eye.
Yeah. So that Super Bowl was really awesome, huh?
I actually watched it online.
Did you?
Yeah.
I loved it because I'm a Broncos fan. I'm from Denver.
You would be. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The first incarnation of this show, which was UFO Think Tank, was it was all started back in Denver, and that's where I got involved with MUFON and everything. So this show is actually a Denver Bronco show by extension. So,
well, I lived out in that area, you know, the Boulder Longmont area,
and
I know how people are such dedicated fans.
Yeah,
a good friend of mine out there had an orange Ford pickup truck. Mm-hmm. He bought it had it ordered, you know, purposely. You know, they are total Bronco fans out there.
So, yeah, and like it's a fun time. I mean, the John Elway era, people were just crazy about Elway. Elway's like a god in Denver. And, of course, he's managing the team, which is so exciting. And now, and then with Manning, you know, who doesn't love Manning? And the storybook ending to his career, because he's most likely going to retire. He has to retire now.
Yeah, right. Who would not want to retire after that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a storybook ending. If he comes back, it's going to be like that weird last chapter, you know, where he's going to struggle, he's older. I mean, it would just be kind of strange. So he's got to kind of, I think, retire at this point, which is fine, because he goes off, you know, with a bang, and how awesome.
Do you think anybody's, like, unplugged their iPod because we're talking sports?
I don't think so, because we're not going to be talking sports long. We're done. Okay. People...
All right.
If you're getting upset, I think that they're nice enough to be like, well, you know, they're Denver people. We can let them have their moment.
They'll humor us a little.
And hopefully they're antsy for a show, and this is going to be a great one because I haven't had one for a couple of weeks. We've been so busy with the UFO Congress, and each week I've been trying to fit a show in and thinking I can, and then it doesn't work out. But I got to tell you guys, we were so busy with the conference, and you know, with the conference, and I think it shows, we are just so hypersensitive about every little minute thing. We want everything to go flawless, mm-hmm. not just for the attendees, definitely for the attendees, but also for the speakers. And I think that's really important. I mean, I think some people, often at these conferences, they're just wanting it to happen. I mean, they're just wanting it to and so, and I can understand that. So people are really overwhelmed, and then it gets difficult for them to see it from the perspective of the attendees or the speakers. You know, luckily, since we've been doing it for so long, what we are very hypersensitive about is that the attendees have a seamless experience, and so do the speakers. That is, I think, mm-hmm. really important that the speakers, 'cause it can be scary for a speaker. Many people don't know this, for especially like Stanton or Travis Walton, who do a lot of conferences, both of whom are going to have tables at the UFO Congress. You know, it's scary to go to this place and you're not sure if they're going to come up with the finances that they say they're going to come up with. And I've had it happen to me. We've all had it happen to us where they don't, and you're left, you know, stuck. Mm-hmm. with that, you know, a bill or something like that. So
yeah, Travis has told me about that happening
yeah,
a few times.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. it's happened. And some well-known, you know, people who have put on conferences in the past, people who, you know, are well-known at this point in the field have done that, have stuck people with, you know, having to pay their own way when they promised them they would. So it can be really difficult. So I know they're nervous if they haven't dealt with us before, or and some of these are professionals. We try to get professionals who haven't dealt with this field before. So we're really hypersensitive that everything goes off seamless. And so that's one of the things that just keeps us so busy. We make sure we're contacting people and arranging things. So yeah, but this year's going very well.
Yeah, there's a lot, people don't realize how many moving parts there are. Just
yeah.
something like putting on any type of conference, and all they see is the finished product. But I know what goes into these type of things because I've been involved with it, and takes so much planning, even mm-hmm. up to a year ahead, mm-hmm. and lots of work on every single little tiny detail.
And ours
you overlook
is
one detail, and it's the weak link.
Right. And yeah. and then it can be devastating. Although a lot mm-hmm. of errors, when there is an error, it's usually devastating for us. But luckily, you know, not many people even notice it happened. So
right.
this is always nice. But still, plus with the conference being so long, it's so many speakers. So yeah, so that's kept me busy. And this is really just a long apology for why I haven't had a show in the
yeah.
last couple of weeks, because people are always like, when are you going to have a show? When are you going to have a show? So, but I think they're used to this time of year, us being on and off with our YouTube videos and with our radio podcasts.
Yeah. The only thing that could ever be the fly in the ointment that I could see out there is if you had bad weather elsewhere in the country and speakers couldn't get out there. That's the only thing I can imagine can be. You know, from what I've witnessed, it's smooth as can be.
Well, that happens. Every year that happens, actually.
Yeah, February's not the best time of year, actually.
Yeah.
Elsewhere in the country.
So, but like Tom Reed had to, last year, he got snowed out. And but almost every year someone has to come maybe on the next plane or come in a little late because of weather. So
yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see. That'll probably happen. And usually we have to rearrange the schedule a bit. So it's yeah. very possible, if not probable, that'll happen. However, the weather here is remarkable. So
it
all
is.
Of a sudden, it was really chilly a couple weeks ago. However, we've got all week long, the highs like in the lower 80s.
Yeah, I saw the weather report. I can't wait.
It was incredible. I got up this morning and went to the car, and it was like, you know, I had a jacket on. I didn't need the jacket. There's this slow breeze that just feels good, and it's just the weather is perfect right now. So I hope it's supposed to stay this way, so it's going to be wonderful. People will even be able to get into the pool, definitely the hot tub.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it's
awesome.
It's turning out. It's everything's looking pretty good so far.
Great.
So I guess let me tell people why today's show is so cool, too, because of our guest. So this is a great guest, and I'm so happy we were able to hook this up. There are a little bit of technical difficulties with he was in another country. He's in Spain, and so the internet was kind of sketchy in the interview. But really, it sounds fine. I mean, I was able to hear him just fine. There's a couple times where he kind of just fades out and in real quick, but no big deal, really. I don't think anything's lost. And I think people can understand but the level, you can still hear him just fine. But this is Chris Aback. Now, Chris, the reason why the timing is so great is that we're going to have Jacques Vallée at the UFO Congress this year. And Chris co-wrote the book Wonders in the Sky with Jacques. So that's Jacques' latest book. Have you read that one?
I have not, no. I plan on picking up. I hope I can get a signed copy from Jacques
yeah.
himself out there.
Get a copy now.
Okay.
Go to the bookstore, because I'm not sure that anybody's going to be selling his book at the conference.
So I'll bring a copy and have him sign it. That's
yeah, exactly. And so if you are planning on coming, bring copies of the Jacques Vallée books, because I'm not sure everybody's going to have them. And at the beginning of the show, Chris says his name really cool. He says it like Jacques Vallée.
Probably the right way.
Yeah, probably the right way, which sounds great. Sounds much better than the way most of us say it. But anyway... over time, he started just saying it like me. But it's cool, yeah, because Chris wrote this book. And this book is really cool because the subtitle is Unexplained Aerial Objects from Antiquity to Modern Times. So it goes into, you know, UFO sightings that way into the past. And it shows that there were similar sightings hundreds, if not thousands of years ago than there are now. And that's what Chris and I talk about on this show, is not only sightings, but also like paranormal experiences and even alien contact kind of experiences and beliefs about where these things come from are similar to what was recorded hundreds, if not thousands of years ago. So, you know, some of our common beliefs about some of the things that we think are, you know, more contemporary, that are more... inventions of the modern time are not necessarily. They actually have, stem from stories that are ancient.
All that stuff fascinates me.
Yeah, very fascinating. He also has a book called Upart. It's in Spanish. It's not in English, but he hopes to get it in English. And Uparts, if you are, I forget what the acronym is, but it's an early ancient aliens acronym for objects that seem, or items that seem like they're out of place, like they're too advanced or something. And so we talk about some ancient alien type of stuff as well. So he's just fascinating, a great thinker, a great researcher, and I think this is some really important historical and sociological type of stuff when it comes to this field.
Awesome. Well, it'll be a great interview to listen to.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. So he's born in London, but now he lives in Spain. So, yeah, this will be a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. And I should say his latest book is Return to Magonia. And some people may recognize that name because one of Jacques Vallée's books is called Passport to Magonia.
Oh, to Magonia.
So Chris's book is Return to Magonia. And I asked Chris, because I never knew this, I guess I didn't remember at least. What is Magonia? Where does that come from? So and he explains that to us too.
Right.
Yeah, so there we go. So that's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get to the interview, let's talk about UFOs in the news. What you got for me?
All right. Well, I am a big fan of objects that drop other objects or expel other type of objects. Not necessarily motherships and all that stuff. You know, I mean, you could speculate. But, okay, so back a while back in Spokane Valley, this is in Washington, there was a really great witnessing and videotaping of this object. And it was the second time the witness had seen this object. And it was a glowing sphere. And this happened on January 26, 2014. So, you know, over a year ago, this is a MUFON report written by Roger Marsh. And so this thing traveled toward the house northbound. It stopped and changed direction to the east. And then it just hovered there. And eventually it expelled this object that was actually larger than itself. It became small, and the object that it dropped kind of faded out. And there's a great video of it. And you can hear the excitement of the witnesses talking and filming. With a couple of words you may have to close your ears to. But anyway, I think it's a great sighting, and I'm kind of interested to hear if we know if someone like, say, Mark D'Antonio or someone ever took a look at this. What do you know about that, Alejandro?
I don't know if D'Antonio did, but the investigator on this case was James Clarkson, who incidentally was one of the UFO, one of the speakers at last year's UFO Congress. He's a great researcher, great guy. I'm a big fan of James. And he had some interesting things to say. He did say he got assistance from William Puckett. who was a guy who does some science. I can't remember his background. It's, it has to do with aerospace or something like that. But I know he's a you know, a well-respected person in like that scientific community and everything. So, but he's retired from NOAA, I guess. So the but yeah, he had gotten some information and about some anomalous radar returns in the area. They also looked at weather, so
which was calm at the time.
Yeah, so there was an pretty extensive investigation of this, because at first I saw the video, I thought it looked similar to other videos I've seen, and I thought, you know, is this a hoax? Is this one of these older videos? But, you know, looking at the investigation, which is pretty thorough, it seems pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I would call it unexplainable for sure.
Mm-hmm. The video, I mean, is pretty interesting when you see this blinking thing and something dropping out of it.
Yeah. Yep. And I don't think there's any way, you know, unfortunately, the video is only filmed while the thing is stationary. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you only have to take the witness, you can only take the witness. This account for the track that it did, the zigzagging apparently. Mm-hmm. But it's just sitting there. But I don't think there's any type of like flare or I don't think a Chinese lander would drop something like that. I don't know. I don't mm-hmm. know. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think so either. I mean, nothing that I know of. So of course, Mark always comes up with something.
He does.
So, you know, I haven't seen. He's in the Open Mind UFO forum. We have an Open Mind UFO News
right.
Facebook forum, and he's usually making comments. And I haven't seen if he's commented on this story yet. Of course, it was only posted on Friday. But I noticed he was in there commenting about other things this weekend. So I haven't had a chance to really look through the comments for the weekend, but I got to check that out. But
I got an email. I got an email this weekend. Someone said to me, "That Mark D'Antonio, does he think anything is ever UFO?" That's what someone wrote me.
Yeah, no, and he doesn't. Well,
I don't think so. I don't know.
He does believe, of course, in UFOs. He, in fact, he thinks he's seen some very strange stuff. I mean, he thinks possibly he's even had alien encounters.
I never heard that.
Yeah, he's experienced lots of strange stuff. So he believes, you know, that there's something going on. It's just that the vast majority, if not all of the videos and pictures he sees, he thinks there could be answers for what those are. But the point is, too, you know, from a perspective, and I learned this from Bruce McAbee way back when, because that was my Mark D'Antonio. And I get frustrated with him when I was an investigator, because I'm like, hey, you know, what's going on with this or that? And he had explanations. And I'm like, but the witness said this. But then I began to get it, which was that they're looking from a perspective, with the video alone, can I prove it was anything unusual? So they'll come up with, just like we do, we're taught to do when you investigate UFOs, they'll come up with, you know, this could be a street lamp, let's say, for instance. I have to then prove that it's not that. And if I can't prove that it's not something mundane, then unfortunately, this, you know, the video is not necessarily debunked, but it's not that extraordinary because I can't prove it's something extraordinary. So it's a high bar they have, and rightly so.
I understand that.
Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to take it to a Seth Shostak, let's say, he's going to say that's a street lamp. Well, no, it's not. How can you prove that it's not? Well, the witness said this. How do you know the witness was telling the truth? Well, and of course, then all you have is anecdotal. It's not evidence. So, I mean, and we need that extraordinary stuff to really stand by when, you know, if we're going to take these to a higher level.
Right. Yep, I agree.
Yeah, but this one, though, I don't know what could do this.
Right. So it's in that gray box, as they say.
Yeah. I have a feeling he might say a drone could do it, but we'll see.
Well, yeah, it would have to have some type of strange lighting to do that, and then to be able to fade out and down to a little, it would have to be very controlled, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look like Mark has commented, so I'm going to put in here, this one is weird, Mark? And then we'll see if he says, see if no, it's fish, not.
See if the fish will bite. Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully everybody is in our Open Mind UFO News forum because we got lots of great conversation going on in there. So another thing I want to talk about, really, we don't have I haven't been able to write any stories. Roger Marsh has posted a couple others, but this video you just mentioned really is the best story from the week. But the other story I want to talk about is, of course, the some sad news, totally shocking news for many of us who knew that he was kind of in hospice care already, but unfortunately, Dr. Edgar Mitchell passed away this week, on Thursday night.
Yes, very sad. And I spoke with someone that knew him, I think it was last summer, and they said he was in poor health. So, yeah too bad. He's a great loss, great man.
Yeah, some others who had been in contact with him, like James Fox, were posting some updates, and they said, you know, he was pretty sick. He was, I think 85 when he passed. So, yeah, one of the few people to actually walk on the moon.
Right.
How extraordinary is that? And I'm sure a lot of people know this, although I've never had him on the show, but I'm sure we've talked about him, I'm sure in the news quite a bit, because he's made a lot of news because he believed. Now, he said he had no direct knowledge. He hadn't seen aliens on the moon or anywhere he had gone or UFOs. However, he had spoken with other astronauts, and he was from Roswell, New Mexico. And he says he spoke with several people in New Mexico, in Roswell, who told him about, you know, what had happened back in 1947. And he says these are trusted people who he believes. So he believed there was a UFO that crashed there, or an alien spacecraft that crashed there in Roswell in 47, near Roswell. He believed all those stories. He believed that aliens were contacting or flying around here. I reposted a post of somebody, and you have to be careful with these alleged quotes. So I can't say for sure this is a real quote. Probably is, though. But it was, we all know that UFOs are real. All we need to ask is, where do they come from and what do they want? And that is a quote, question credited to Edgar Mitchell. So, yeah, he was very
into the topic. Yeah, something that keeps me going, actually. That same comment. And you know, I had a number of conversations with Alan Bean, who was the fourth person to step on the moon, about walking on the moon and what people are calling it a hoax and all that. And he says he doesn't try to change anyone's mind. But also, he was involved in the 1973 Skylab UFO picture. I'm not sure, Skylab 3, back in 1973. Incredible pictures that they took. He has absolutely no interest in talking about UFOs. And so that was really good that Edgar actually took and risked his reputation or whatever and actually would talk about it.
So what did he think was in the picture?
Are you talking about Alan Bean?
Yeah.
Alan wouldn't really discuss it with me. He said he didn't want to talk about it. So I think he just wants to forget about it, and I talked to him briefly last year about it, and I had him actually on. He's a very good artist, and I had him on my antique and art podcast, and so that's how I got to know him.
Interesting.
It's nothing to do with it.
So there's only 12 people to walk on the moon. Of those 12 people, two of them were very into UFOs and paranormal phenomena. One being, of course, Edgar Mitchell, who we talked about. The other being Harrison Schmitt. And he was really into and participated in the cattle mutilation stuff.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Wow. And actually, in my talk or my video that I go over the whole Richard Doty UFO disinformation thing, Harrison Schmitt knew Paul Benowitz, who was a UFO guy, and Harrison Schmitt came and to ask Doty what's going on with this Paul Benowitz stuff. because Paul Benowitz was saying, hey, you know, the military is looking into my UFOs. And so, yeah, Harrison Schmitt kind of followed the field. So two of them. Some people say that Buzz Aldrin or Neil Armstrong were into UFOs or stuff like that, but they're not. At least if they were at some point, they say they're not. So, of course, Neil Armstrong's no longer
right.
around, but Buzz yep. Aldrin is alive, and he does say he's not into that topic at all. He does make weird statements once in a while, like, well, we should
yes.
investigate these tall spears on planets or stuff like that. So maybe personally he does believe, but he just doesn't want to say that publicly. But publicly he's made it very clear that and several occasions he's, I think even on Coast to Coast and some other stuff, that he's not into and doesn't believe in that sort of thing. But
now, wasn't he on Larry King? Talking, they're debating about UFOs.
Yeah, and it was really frustrating because he kept going into these long things, and Larry King's like, hey, get
totally
cut to
different.
The chase.
Yeah.
And he was saying, okay, yeah, there it wasn't a UFO I saw, even though I was talking about it being a UFO. It was this part of the rocket. And so
I think Larry King was very frustrated with him.
I think he was, because he had kind of waffled and made comments prior to that interview that seemed like he did think he saw a UFO. So that's why Larry King wanted to figure out what the heck he was talking about. And then he was hemming and hawing around the topic and finally said no. And he wanted to be very clear. No, I did not see anything strange. But, he's kind of weird about the topic.
Yeah. I can understand with the pressure.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I never even got to meet Dr. Edgar Mitchell. He's a busy guy, I know. And in the last few years, he hasn't been able to travel. So most of the appearances he's made were via Skype,
right?
Because his health had been failing. So, but of course, lots of our friends have met and interviewed Dr. Mitchell, and he was well loved. He'll definitely be missed. I mean, I think this is some pretty big news for the UFO community.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Well, I think that's all the news for now. Otherwise, the UFO Congress starts. We're going to be hauling stuff in a week.
Right. Wow.
So, yeah, that we're going to get rolling. And then a week from tomorrow is the movies. And I guess I should reiterate the film festival. We show all of the entries on Tuesday beginning at 9 a.m. And anyone can come and watch those. That's at the Wekapaw Conference Center, where the conference is. So if you want to come watch those, come on down. And
right.
anybody, if you're going to see all the films in one particular category, then you can also be a judge. So J.K. Scott, who runs it, will be there, and she'll be organizing that. So, yeah, come and judge if you have the time. And some great entries this year. And then the top three in each category are showing on Thursday and Friday night. They're only showing once again. They're not all showing on Thursday and Friday night. We show the three from the two categories, so that's six films spread throughout Thursday and Friday night. So even if you can't make it Tuesday, you'll be able to see at least the top ones on Thursday and Friday. So that's always a lot of fun.
I can't wait.
Yeah, so it'll be cool. So I guess we'll see you there, buddy.
You bet. I will be rolling out there soon.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us for the news.
Fun as always.
Let's go ahead and talk to Chris. I am very excited to welcome to the show Chris Aubach. And you're in Spain right now, right?
Hi there. Yeah, I am. I'm in a small town called Motril, which is on the southern coast of Spain. Uh-huh. And it's nice here. It's good weather all year round.
Uh-huh. Well, that's exciting. Spain looks beautiful. I've never been there, but it's definitely one of the places I want to visit one day.
Well, you're welcome to pay me a visit whenever you want.
Great.
I'll show you around.
Well, it's going to be a goal then to take you up on that because, this is actually, I'm excited to talk to you because you've worked with, one of the greats. And, of course, the books, at least, your book with Jacques, the latest one, the Wonders in the Sky was excellent. It's one of my favorite books ever. But and I've been intending to talk to you ever since I got to interview Jacques, and I was so happy to do that for that book. And of course, now I'm really excited for the chance to meet him in a few weeks. He's going to be speaking at our big UFO conference that we do. Surprisingly, were you aware of that actually?
Yeah, he did mention it to me. He doesn't do a lot of conferences. I had a conference myself in Madrid in May, and he came to that, which I was very I was very grateful that he did, because it's hard to get good ufologists from the States to come to Spain. It's mainly a question of money, timing. I mean, it's not that easy to bring people across from such far away places. But fortunately, Jacques spends a lot in France, so it wasn't too far for him on this occasion. And yeah, he gave us a great talk. And I'm hoping that I can do another conference like that in a year or so.
Great, that's exciting. And I understand what you mean, because we used to have more international speakers as well for our conference, but it gets so expensive to fly people back and forth that it makes it really difficult.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's just, yeah, I mean, some people think that there's a lot of money in publishing books, and there isn't. It's mainly a work of it's hobbies, really. And you can't make a lot of money from publishing books and magazine articles and so on. So there are no funds really to support this kind of venture. So it's a question of luck and the generosity of organizations if they can bring speakers over from other countries.
So I do want to ask, we'll definitely get into your background and the books that you've written, but out of curiosity, now that we're talking about Jacques, and of course this is Jacques Vallée for the listeners, I'm sure they know because I've of course been gushing about and excited about him coming to the conference. However, I do want to ask, how did you first meet him and begin to work with him?
Well, when I arrived in Spain in the year 1991, which was really a massive adventure, I didn't know where I was going or what I was going to do. I just had a few books with me, and one was his. I believe it was Passport to Magonia, and I realized that I wanted to spend a lot of time on researching historical UFO cases, and the best person to do that with, or at least to contact about that kind of thing, was Jacques Vallée. And but in the early 90s, there was no way that I could possibly find his address or anything. I was totally isolated and small Spanish town, and this was before internet arrived. I mean, even if it existed elsewhere in the world, it certainly wasn't in Cáceres in Extremadura in Spain. But in the year 1997, I finally got my hands on a computer, and I discovered the internet, or what was the internet in 1997. It was a lot more limited than it is now. And I sent my first ever email, and it was to Jacques Vallée, and because I just found his email on some random web page, and he replied. And about 3 years later, when I moved to Madrid, there I had better internet access. I sort of reinitiated our correspondence, and I invited him to the group that I was forming at the time. He said, "Yeah, I want to be a part of that." And then I went to visit him in Portugal. He came to do a conference on something to do with cosmology, and I took a train to Oporto to go and visit him. And I was with him and his wife, now sadly has died, Janine. And we spent a few days together, and it was great. I was like talking to him about my future projects with books, and I said, "Why don't we write a book together?" And he said to me, "No." But I didn't care. I went back to England. I mean, sorry, I went to Spain, and about a year later, I was wandering around the supermarket buying cheese, and he called me and he said, "I've changed my mind. Let's write something together." So that's basically it. He was the first guy I ever wrote an email to, and then I went to visit him in Portugal.
How cool! What a great story. Your first email. You know, I don't know who my...
Yeah, you know, it's nice.
That's really funny. I don't know who my first email was to. That's really... Now you have me wondering who that might have been to. Might have been my mom, or it very likely could have been UFO-related or something. But so the organization you said you created that you invited him to join, what sort of organization was that?
Yeah, in the year 2003, in April 2003, I founded a group of UFO experts, writers, researchers, and so on to try to bring together all of the material published in centuries past. So we're talking about the early 19th century, the early 20th century, and the centuries before that. Anything published which might give us a clue as to UFO phenomena observed in historical times. And the group's called Magonia Exchange. It's been going on for like 13 years now. And we've collected about 30,000 different objects, documents, 30,000 items, which includes cuttings and manuscripts and pages from diaries and images and so on, published over the last 300 or 400 years, which seem to show that the UFO phenomenon has been going on for this long. It's something which has never really gone away. So, yeah, we've collected all this information together, and by analyzing it, by doing statistical analyses, and by researching the individual cases, at least we can prove that people have believed in practically the same things for at least 300 years.
Mm-hmm. So, and the term Magonia, like, what does that mean to you? What is its importance?
Well, Magonia itself originally referred to a place, an unknown place, somewhere outside France. It could have been in the sky, or it could have been another dimension, or it could have been an enemy country. Nobody really knows where it was, but about 1,500 years ago, the French, the superstitious farmers, that kind of people, believed that ships were coming from this mysterious kingdom of Magonia. They were coming through the sky and stealing the crops. And it was connected with traditions about spirits involved with thunderstorms and so on. But it was a term which Jacques Vallée took to describe these historical accounts of UFOs and encounters. So he used it for the title of his book, Passport to Magonia. So when I started my group, I called it Magonia Exchange. Exchange, of course, means that all the members had to send whatever material they had at home, which most of us as researchers have boxes and boxes of documents and photocopies and clippings just rotting away in the attic. Mm-hmm. And because nowadays it's so easy to scan or just take a photo of the documents that you have, then they could send it to the group and then we could share it among all of us. And that's why it's called Magonia Exchange. And of course, my latest book with Martin Schoff is called Return to Magonia, which again is sort of in honor of Jacques Vallée's original seminal study, Passport to Magonia.
Mm-hmm. And now, was your first book Uparts?
Well, that's a book which I published in Spanish last September. I wouldn't say it was my first book, but it was a book which I published in Spanish with a historian from the Complutense university called Juanjo Sanchez Oro. And what we do in that book is to gather as many uparts or stories about uparts, which of course are out-of-place artifacts, that is, objects which seem to be too advanced for the time period that they correspond with, like finding a nail or a hammer in a lump of rock or coal, mm-hmm. to bring all those stories together, analyze them, and see which of those could be proved true and which of them should be rejected as fakes or misunderstandings and so on. So, yeah, I'm hoping to publish the same book one day in English, because I think it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, it's kind of an ancient aliens topic, which, of course, is really popular.
That's right, yeah.
And so
it is. These days, ancient aliens. Yeah, it's something which I'm very interested in, because ancient aliens is a topic that's never really gone away.
Mm-hmm. So getting into the topics of the book, looking historical into, you know, people, stories that are similar to current UFO stories, what are some of the trends that you've seen?
Well, the first thing is that people have, you know, over the last 2,000 years, people have reported very similar looking objects in the sky. Mm-hmm. I don't really have any particular belief about what they represent, but it is true that many of them seem to be a little bit similar. For example, when I was working on Return to Magonia with Martin Schoff, we found a series of stories about the moon, which opens up in the middle of the sky, so it couldn't have been the moon, obviously, and entities came out of the sphere, the white sphere, and would either dance around the sky or descend to the earth. There are a lot of stories which are very similar and which were told over you know, several generations, which seem to indicate, if not the presence of an anomaly in the sky, at least it shows how human imagination works very much according to the same principles, no matter what century we happen to be in. So that's, you know, that's one thing I found. Also, in my own research into historical accounts of abduction by strange entities, you can find very similar stories repeated throughout time, even involving babies, hybrids, all this kind of thing, which is very similar to what abductees are reporting today. I don't want to say whether this is, I can't really say whether this is true, whether it's actually happening, or it's just a part of natural human imagination. But it's certainly worth looking at, because, you know, we're looking at the same stories being told over a very long period, probably at least 1,000 years. In fact, there was a 17th century mystic called Jane Laird who wrote not only about her UFO sightings, but also about how she found herself transported to a star in the sky or at some otherworldly place where she met angelic beings who showed her children or who showed her different things about the universe. These are stories which seem to reoccur with every generation.
Mm-hmm. Which is fascinating, especially because, you know, I think a lot of people have the feeling, and even a lot of researchers, that a lot of this is a new phenomena.
Well, when we think about how old ufology might be, or the belief in extraterrestrial life might be, on the one hand, we have sightings that go back to Sumerian times, and we can find documents, very old documents from medieval times, ancient Chinese documents, thousands of years old, that describe things in the sky that they didn't know how to identify. But then, on the other hand, there's this belief, a corresponding belief that the universe was populated by intelligent beings, which is an idea that originated in ancient Greece among a school of philosophy. For example, the atomists believe that the universe was teeming with life very similar to our own. But it's an idea that has continued throughout the ages, and especially since the medieval period, people have wondered whether other planets are populated by intelligent beings like ourselves. So all of this shows that ufology has very deep roots. It doesn't mean that UFOs are really here. It doesn't mean extraterrestrials really visit us. I'm not going to express an opinion about that at this stage. But it does mean that at least the idea of extraterrestrial visits has been continuous throughout history.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I find this fascinating, too, because I'm very into the historical and sociological aspects as well, especially when, you know, myself writing a lot about these stories and following, you know, the origins of them, some of them turn out to be dubious. However, the idea that this is a part of our history and our, you know, mythos is important, and it seems that academia often shies away from the topic, even though it is prevalent enough to warrant, I think, research, just because of kind of the how the topic is viewed, it doesn't get the attention perhaps that it should.
Well, it sort of depends on what topic we're referring to. For example, the idea that that the universe might be populated is a subject that's, well, there have been very good academic books written just about this idea that maybe we're living in a universe inhabited by lots of intelligent beings. Then the idea that people have seen strange things in the sky, that also gets some degree of attention from scholars, particularly people who study the history of meteorological phenomena, meteors, comets, and so on. Where ufologists get frustrated is that academics don't normally like to speculate about the nature of UFOs themselves. They don't like to connect those two dots, the idea that we're living in a universe possibly full of life, and that maybe the lights in the sky have an extraterrestrial origin. They might be piloted by beings from another planet. This is something that frustrates a lot of academics, but I don't think that's ever going to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the aspect of whether or not people are being abducted. I mean, like you say, there's this history that goes way back of people believing they've had some sort of experience being whisked away by strange creatures, and whether or not that's happened, it's certainly a very prevalent story. And it seems to me there are so many people these days making these claims, believing to have had these sort of experiences, that it does warrant some attention, but it doesn't seem to get that.
Well, the problem is that the people who pay it, well, the academics, the scholars who pay attention to abduction reports, don't normally reach the same conclusions as ufologists do. So they might study it as a kind of folklore or as a socio-cultural phenomenon, something which corresponds with UFOs and a belief in extraterrestrial visits, which started really around the middle of the 19th century. But the thing is not that people don't look into abduction claims seriously, but the conclusions they reach don't really satisfy UFO researchers. If you look into any archive of university articles, reports on the internet or in any good university library, you'll find studies of this kind of of thing, this kind of phenomenon. Simply, they're not published in UFO magazines. Most UFO writers don't get to see them, and they don't draw any conclusions that support the idea that UFOs are really abducting us. So it's not that it doesn't happen, it's just that they reach a completely different set of conclusions.
Well, I don't see that. I don't see that it happens. Because I think it would be interesting, even at the psychological, or especially at a psychological level, that it should be looked at regardless of the conclusions. But maybe, do you see that more in Europe? Because I don't see that in the U.S. I don't see academic studies, very, very far and few between.
Well, I don't see, I mean, I probably have on my computer about 25 or 30 academic studies of abduction phenomena, UFOs, close encounters, and so on. I mean, they do exist. There's certainly not as many good academic studies of this as there are normal generic ufological studies of the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they're not given a lot of publicity either, so it's not something that you'll find easily. But you know, people have actually written university theses on this topic. The main thing is, though, that their conclusions, as I said, differ from those of most ufologists. But it's like, for example, the topic of ancient astronauts, because mm-hmm. this is thing we're vulnerable again in the last few years, mainly because of TV documentaries. But you can also find some good serious studies of the history of this and what it means. I've seen academic reports comparing a belief in ancient astronauts with racism, for example. The idea that why do we have to suppose that our ancestors were too stupid to build the monuments that some of us think might have come from outer space or have been built by aliens. So, I mean, this kind of study does exist. Simply, you have to really search for it to find it. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that end is interesting. It seems like that end is a little more accessible. There seem to be, just because it is more prevalent, and there's, I guess, more hands-on you can do, and it's not as fringe as some of the others. But kind of moving away from that, I guess, and moving into the ancient aliens kind of arena, this is kind of an area where it's more than just folklore, but you actually have something physical to examine. Although I completely agree with you. I mean, in that one of the things I think that your stories, or some of what the things that you've just talked about now, are just how advanced previous cultures have been in philosophy, in governance, and I think that these days we believe ourselves to be maybe a lot more advanced in those ways than we were in the past, and we actually were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the problem with this is that a lot of people don't really know much about history, and they don't know a lot about how cultures have evolved, how science has evolved over the years. When you look at the development of science and scientific discoveries, most of the mysteries of the world, things like the Easter Island statues or the Great Pyramid, do slot in quite well into the established and known history of each of these civilizations. I've never really seen any reason to say that our ancestors couldn't have created the monuments of Egypt or anywhere in the world, South America. I think this is one of the biggest flaws with the ancient astronaut theory. People have to start reading history books again and looking into the origins of this. The thing is, the ancient astronaut theory was developed first a very, very long time ago, and much, it's much older than Eric von Däniken and the Ancient Astronaut Society, which I used to belong to when I was younger. Mm-hmm. In fact, the ancient astronaut theory was first developed in the year 1823 in France, and it's never gone away. It's something which has persisted. For, well, it's going to be 200 years soon. Originally, most of the books published in the early 19th century said that our ancestors might have come from another planet and brought science with them. And they speculated that that planet had been a body in our universe that had exploded or was destroyed by a comet or something, and that the remnants of that planet were scattered across the solar system, and a lot of them had fallen onto Earth. And this was a very popular theory throughout the 19th century. The problem is that the theory existed before any proof did, and that's another flaw in the ancient astronaut hypothesis today. The theory exists, and so people search desperately for proof to support it, but in my experience, I haven't found any uparts that have really convinced me that they could have only come from another planet or have been built by an especially advanced civilization. So I don't know. It's something that interests me a lot. When people ask me about this, I often mention that in the 1870s, a French scientist called Dufresne said that he thought that Australia itself, the whole continent, had come from outer space as an asteroid. He believed that maybe Australia had fallen from out of space into the Pacific Ocean, that this had caused Noah's flood and other natural disasters, and that this explains why there are so many strange animals on that continent, and plants and things that you won't find anywhere else in the world. But when you look at it, you realize that the only reason he said this was that it gave this was according to him, not according to me, it gave white colonizers an excuse to take the land away from the Australian natives, because they said, well, if it's fallen into our territory, it must belong to us now.
You're kidding.
There was so much written.
And that excuse was actually used to take land away.
Yes.
Wow,
yeah.
The dangers of ancient astronaut theory.
Well, that's true. And not much has changed since then, perhaps, you know. Uh-huh. But and it's something that you can find again and again. There have been a lot of theories in the past which have said, well, these monuments, for example, there was a guy in the 1860s who said that the statues on Easter Island could only have come from another planet that had exploded and just scattered them across the universe. And it was a way of saying, well, the islanders that we see today in the Pacific are too stupid to have made these monuments themselves. So if they don't really belong to them, then, you know, we can take them for ourselves. And that's just an argument they used again and again. There's a strong political motivation behind a lot of these ancient astronaut theories, unfortunately.
That's really interesting. And it's funny because as you've been talking, I've been thinking about it's interesting that Easter Island, some of these other mysteries that were suspected to be extraterrestrial in origins have kind of been discovered. Like, they've discovered ways how humans probably did do these things. At the same time, even though some of these theories have kind of been debunked pretty much, the ancient aliens theory gets more and more popular. And one thing that we kind of highlighted this was the last episode of the X-Files, where at the beginning, Mulder was brooding because he's like, you know, since we've been away, which has been since the series was on before, they've debunked all of these different things that he thought, you know, were due to aliens, which is kind of funny. But
yeah,
even though
right.
that's happened, the idea gets more and more popular.
Yeah, it is interesting how that's happened. I mean, obviously a lot of it's because of this documentary series. What's it called? Ancient Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not something which I generally watch, and I mean I can see the attraction, but as I said, it's something that's attracted people since the year 1823, and you know, the proof for these ideas has never got any better. In the 19th century, there was absolutely no proof at all, but it was still a very, very popular topic. I mean, even Madame Blavatsky was, you know, was influenced by this idea, and many books were published at that time saying that the Martians had come to Earth, like straddled on a meteorite or something, and they had initiated human civilization. In the book Uparts, which I published with my friend Juanjo Sanchez Odo last September here in Spain, we look at all of the geological mysteries, like these geological artifacts, like for example when they found a coin or a chain or a nail inside a lump of coal at some geological level that would indicate that these objects must be millions of years old. And the problem is that most of them, I mean, not all of them, but most of these stories which have been used in the last couple of decades by writers like Michael Cremer, who wrote Forbidden Archaeology, and a lot of other people who believe in either creationism, which is a group that supports the existence of Uparts, or people who just want to say that, who want to believe that extraterrestrials were here thousands of years ago. A lot of these artifacts were published in newspapers at a time when the press was desperately trying to compete with the Europeans who were reporting finds of giant dinosaur bones and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a period when North America, because most of these artifacts only appeared in North American newspapers, we find, were trying to show that there had been a golden age in North American prehistory that competed with, or even was better than, the golden age of the old world, that is Europe, Greece, and Egypt, and so on. So while the curators of British or European museums were saying, oh, we have these enormous dinosaur bones, the Americans were saying, well, our dinosaur bones are much bigger. And while Europeans were saying, well, we have these wonderful Greek monuments, and here we have the biblical lands, and maybe the biblical patriarchs walked across this land in ancient times. Then in North America, they said, well, here too, we have this, and we found Egyptian tablets. And then, of course, Mormonism sprang up, where they said, well, basically, biblical patriarchs also walked here. So Uparts date from a period when North America was competing directly with Europe to establish this wonderful golden past for itself. Mm-hmm. But when you look into the cases, the individual artifacts, you normally find that they never existed at all, or they were invented by the editor of the newspaper. You know, sometimes you read Mrs. Smith or whatever found a golden chain in a lump of coal that indicates that there was an advanced civilization here hundreds of thousands of years ago. When you look into who this woman was, you discover that she was the wife of the newspaper editor. You know, what a coincidence. And so on and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's a big topic. It's an interesting topic. And I'd like to write about it seriously in the future. And who knows, maybe a real Upart might materialize. I live in hope.
Right. And that's what's great about this stuff, because it's something that me and my girlfriend argue about often, where she's like, well, how did that happen? But just because we don't know its origins, and it doesn't mean it's not a genuine mystery, but it also doesn't necessarily mean it's aliens, and which is always my argument, which is, you know, something that I appreciate, even though it frustrates people, about Jacques, who's always, you know, been there to say, hey, wait a minute. We don't know what the origins of X, Y, Z or the origins of this mystery, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's aliens. It could be something altogether different.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, I mean, every scientific field has its mysteries. If you look into botany and astrophysics and geology and biology, every scientific field has its mysteries, has its frauds and hoaxes, has its wild speculation, has its strange, you know, data that no one knows exactly what to do with, its advocates and its debunkers. There isn't a scientific field in the world that doesn't have all of that. And so it's not surprising at all that ufology also has this. And it's not a scientific field, really, ufology, but it is one in which there's a lot of passionate debate about what all this means. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it doesn't have to be aliens. Of course, it could be something else entirely. We have to somehow sort of cut away this obsession that we have with alien visitors and open our minds to other possibilities, whether they're, you know, whether we should look for more mundane explanations, psychosocial ones, or whether it's interdimensional travelers who are here on a shopping spree. You know, we have to open minds to as many theories as possible, but then, only present theories using proper facts rather than, you know, present every crazy idea that occurs to us.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, too, just don't like not knowing. So it's easy to say, oh, that's aliens. It's done. It's much easier to have a black and white kind of world where things are either X, Y, or Z, but it's harder to say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think it's important to look at the origins of all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
which is what interests me. As I said, I don't know what, you know. I just want to find out where it all comes from. That's what fascinates me.
Well, that's what's fascinating about your work, because I think that that's terribly important, because, like you've noted, it can demonstrate that the UFO phenomena or the alien abduction phenomena are not necessarily new things, that these are things that people have been reporting or talking about for a very long time.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, that's what I'm interested in particularly. And that's why I have this group, Magonia Exchange, which if anyone listening is interested in joining, you know, they can find me on Facebook or at chrisorbit.com, you know, and they can join the hunt for historical cases. And at the same time, it's the reason why I'm fascinated by the origin of some of the typical terms that we use, the terminology in ufology, because people don't know quite often where this comes from. In the book Return to Magonia, which I published with Martin Schoff just a couple of months ago, we talk about the origin of the term flying saucer and how that predates Kenneth Arnold by probably about 50 years or so. You know,
really?
The expression, yeah, flying saucer, I mean, it wasn't invented in 1947 at all. It comes from, originally the word flying saucer came into existence to describe the little discs which were thrown for trap shooters to practice on. Mm-hmm. And it was an expression that was used from the beginning of the 20th century, probably around 1906, 1907. You can find it, you know, for decades. And when, I mean, even in 1947, people, I mean, before Arnold, the term flying saucer was still in quite common use to describe these discs. So I find it interesting because most of us realize that UFOs are not usually disc-shaped. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's this question, why do we call them flying saucers if they're not actually disc-shaped most of the time? And we reached the conclusion that it's probably because it was such a popular expression at the time, flying saucer, that people just kept on using it, even though they were looking at hexagonal-shaped objects, cube-shaped objects, and so on. So, you know, the popularity of this pre-existing term, flying saucer, probably helped shape the evolution of ufology, you know, because these days people associate disc-shaped things with spaceships.
Now, the term flying saucer, so when they first started using that term, was it because they were describing things in the sky that looked like the flying saucers?
If you look back to the origins of the sport, trap shooting, you find that in 1882, it was very similar to an Adamski-like flying saucer, was patented by a guy called George Ligowski. And it was an aerodynamic disc, and it was just used for the sport. But because people saw the term constantly throughout those decades, when Kenneth Arnold described his object, the term just stuck with us, and then it sort of became more associated with spaceships than it had been with sport. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that you look back in ancient, you know, in historical newspapers, and you can see headlines like "The gunners are blazing away at the flying saucers," or "They're trying to knock flying saucers out of the sky," and these come from the 1920s, 1930s. Mm-hmm. In 1944, there was a headline in a newspaper, and it was "Flying saucers are knocking Axis airplanes out of the sky," and the headline referred to trap shooting, and the fact that trap shooting had been adopted as a sport by the United States Army to train aerial gunners before sending them into battle. And this program was actually headed by a man called General Arnold, General Henry H. Arnold. And he suggested firing flying saucers into the sky, which people would try to shoot down, you know, on the practice range. And it was only 3 years later that Kenneth Arnold became associated with flying saucers. And, you know, that new extension to the expression flying saucer was born.
I want to ask you too, before we're done, about another expression, which is little green men. And I do this talk, and I'm going to be doing this talk at the UFO Congress this year, about these interesting cases. And I've been talking about how kind of this case, the Hopkinsville, Kentucky kind of case, popularized that term. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I hadn't realized, and I thought, I was actually under the impression that that's kind of where the term got coined in reference to extraterrestrials. But then somebody sent me a link to some research of yours where that has also been around for a period of time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the term little green men definitely did originate with, you know, in the flying saucer period. It had been used before 1947 in different ways. It seems that it originated as a part of fairy mythology, you know, to describe goblins and elves and so on, because they were often green-skinned or dressed in green. So people referred to little green men. The first time that little green man or little green men ever occurred in a story, you know, a fictional account, would have probably been in Washington Irving's Knickerbocker's History of New York, which is from 1809, in which the men in the moon have decided to invade Earth. The Lunarians regard humans as like primitive animals with grotesque bodies and horrible white skin, as opposed to the pea green complexions of the moon people. So the people from the moon consider humans completely incapable of running the planet themselves. They even say that humans infest it, like parasites or rodents. So the moon people decide to send a group of little green Lunarians to the Earth to colonize it. In the name of the moon, you know, which is a little bit like what we were talking talking about before, the idea that a race of extraterrestrials might consider us too primitive to really have a right over, you know, our own planet is a bit like us saying that our ancestors were too stupid to have come up with their own technology. So, yeah, I mean, this is the first time it ever appeared, I suppose, in 1809. But if you look in archives of 19th century newspapers, you find little green men, or someone says, oh, he's always seeing little green men, or he's always drunk and dreaming of little green men. Yeah, it was a very common expression at one point, long before it was ever associated with some other planets.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Would it be accurate then to say, though, that it kind of the term got kind of a resurgence when the UFOs began to get popular again?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there was this massive resurgence of all these different motifs, little green men as aliens and so on. I mean, you know, in the work that I'm doing is to find the historical roots of a lot of our UFO myths. For example, Roswell, I mean, it has so many parallels throughout the 19th century that it's amazing that people had forgotten them all when you know, flying saucers erupted on the scene. There's just so much that still has to come to light, I'm sure, too. We're going to find stories about spaceships full of little green men in some 19th century newspaper in the end.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of other topics do you tackle in your latest book?
Right. Well, what we've done is to gather 20 or so cases, which Martin Schoff and I consider to be anomalous in some way. I mean, a lot of people listening to me might think that I reject the existence of UFOs as some kind of psychosocial phenomenon. But we do realize that there are some very impressive reports. And in fact, I saw one myself. I saw a UFO myself in the year 1996, and I've no idea what it was. It was a luminous orange rectangle in the sky, and just over a village in Spain. So I realize that something happens. You know, weird things do happen in the sky. So what we did in this book, in Return to Magonia, was to collect 20 historical cases, and we've analyzed them as much as possible. What we've done is to take the newspaper report or a report from a scientific journal, for example, the year 1757 or 1832, we've extracted all the names, so all the names of the witnesses, the places, and so on, calculated the day, the exact location of the sighting, and then using genealogical records, we've been able to establish whether the witnesses existed, using other sources of information to see if it really was raining on that day, or it really was sunny, just as the witnesses described. I mean, all of this information is available in archives, and internet just has opened a whole world of knowledge to us. We can now determine whether historical cases were probably authentic or not, just by studying them using the resources that have become available in the last few years. So we look at 17th century stories from the 1660s, for example, in England, where three volumes of very strange reports, like as if they'd come from Charles Fort's pen, were published as a kind of religious propaganda at the time, or political propaganda, but using sort of the resources that we have, a digital planetarium to calculate the positions of the stars, the sun, the moon, we're able to show that, you know, people were reporting quite faithfully what they'd seen in a lot of these cases. And then we just go through time until around 1947. So it's probably the first time anyone's ever collected 20 good historical cases together and done a very deep research into all of them, getting all the details and establishing all the facts.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like then some of them, even after analysis, remain mysterious.
Exactly. I mean, this is it. Altogether, we probably did about 40 different studies, and this book brings together 20 of them. And I'd say that all of them have some kind of anomaly, some weird effect, something that we couldn't explain. I think there's only one story there which we could find an explanation for. The rest of them really are quite strange. I mean, one of my favorites actually is from the year 1873, and it happened in Ohio. I don't know why so many strange things happen in Ohio, but I think Ohio is the state which has contributed more Fortean or UFO cases to the Magonia Exchange archive. You know, it's something happens there, something weird. And do you know the case from 1873 that was reported just outside Zanesville? Have you heard of this one before?
No, it doesn't sound familiar. I may have read about it, but it's not ringing a bell right now.
Well, I'll tell you about this. It's quite interesting. I can read a part of it. It says, one evening about 2 weeks ago, while Mr. Inman, who was a farmer, and his son were returning to their home from Taylorsville, they saw a light which they describe as looking like a burning brush pile near the zenith, descending rapidly towards the earth with a loud roaring noise. It struck the ground in the road a short distance from them. The blazing object flickered and flared for a few moments and then faded into darkness, as a man dressed in a complete suit of black and carrying a lantern emerged from it. The man walked a few paces and stepped into a buggy which had not been observed before by either Mr. Inman or his son. There was no horse attached to this supernatural vehicle, but no sooner had the man taken his seat than it started to run noiselessly but with great velocity along the highway, and it continued to do so until it reached a steep gully into which it plunged, when buggy, man, and lantern suddenly disappeared as mysteriously as they came. And this story is very exciting because we're talking about a mysterious object that flies across the sky and it lands in front of the witnesses. It opens up, an entity comes out carrying some kind of torch or lantern, gets into what sounds like an automobile, but in 1873 there were no automobiles. Mm-hmm. You know, the concept practically didn't exist yet, and you know, he sped away in this vehicle. So this is the kind of story we're looking at in the book.
Fascinating. The book sounds very fascinating. I'm definitely going to get it as soon as I can. I don't have it yet, but I mean, I loved Wonders in the Sky, and I really loved this conversation. This was a lot of fun. I'm glad we were able to finally get together to do this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And people can go to chrisaubeck.com, and we'll have the link, of course, on the website. But just for those listening who are impatient, you can go to chrisaubeck.com. And you can also find Return to Magonia, Wonders in the Sky, at Amazon.
That's right, yeah. And hopefully this year I'll be releasing another book. And I'm working on a thesis at the moment. It's going to be the complete history of extraterrestrial visitation and objects and spaceships that have crashed on the Earth, allegedly, who knows, or maybe they really happened, from 1847 to 1947. And that's going to be the most complete study of its kind.
Well, that's fascinating. It's great because, you know, people are always talking about wanting to, because a lot of people rehash old stories, but this is all stuff that people don't know about, even though they are very old stories, older than many of them that people are talking about. But these are things that people, you know, they're retrieved from the archives, stories people in modern times don't know about.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, honestly, it's amazing that it begins in 1847 with the fall of this artificial object from the sky. It caused a crater and so on. Then just a few years later, again allegedly, a piece of masonry apparently fell from the sky into Jamaica, and it was covered in like hieroglyphics and figures and things. And even then, in 1862, people said, well, this must have come from another planet. And then, you know, throughout the 1860s, 1870s, meteorites with writing on the outside or with objects inside, like a book or a device, a mummified alien, and stories of this kind abounded throughout the 19th century. So finally, I'm bringing them all together and showing how the idea of crashed spaceships really originated 100 years before any of us suspected.
Wow. These sound like a bunch of Doctor Who stories. And I love Doctor Who.
It could be. Maybe I should sell them.
Yeah, maybe. They're great. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we'll have you on again sometime in the future.
Okay, thank you very much, then.
That was a lot of fun. So I love the historical and the sociological aspect of this phenomena. In fact, I find that perhaps the most interesting because I kind of have this feeling that, you know, if there's going to be any sort of open contact or disclosure or whatever, it's not up to us. It's up to, if there's a third party coming here, it's up to them. So we're kind of spinning our wheels with anything else, I feel. I just don't think, and even if the government does have some group that is looking into this, I don't think they have a whole lot of answers, much more than we all have, because, you know, we seem to forget that we're dealing with a much more advanced civilization, most likely, you know, of course, if there is a visitation like that going on, or if more along the lines of what Jacques Vallée talks about, it's something that we can't even conceive. Even if you look at the Skinwalker Ranch, you know, we've got one of our top interviews online is actually John Alexander, you know, retired colonel, worked in Army Intelligence. Investigated Skinwalker Ranch with the Bigelow Group, talking about how, and I've talked to other scientists with the Bigelow Group, and they feel the same way, that the intelligence, which they felt it was, this unknown intelligence, was way smarter than they were. It outsmarted them, and they really could not, you know, make heads or tails of things, except for that there was some strange phenomena and some strange intelligence that was messing with them, that had abilities beyond theirs. So they really felt there was something going on. They just didn't know what it was or who it was, and it was just too smart for them. So that being the case, we're kind of chasing our tails, or at least sitting on the sidelines here, watching and learning and, you know, keeping an eye to see if something happens. But what we do know is there is a phenomena. Whether that phenomena be purely psychological, it's certainly sociological, in that there are hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people that believe that we're being visited, or they believe they have had an experience with extraterrestrials, or any other paranormal kind of experience. And so because there's all of these people having these experiences or believing they've had these experiences, and just, you know, even if these experiences are not a physical experience or even there is no third party involved, it is an experience. And so it deserves to be studied. I don't know that I agree with Chris that I don't think that, you know, a handful of studies is necessarily sufficient. I think that there would be more studies if this topic was taken more seriously, because I think there needs to be more studies. I think that abduction phenomena needs to be much more closely examined. That's why I don't shy away from covering it, even though a lot of people think, you know, you're going to hurt your credibility talking about alien abduction. But you know what? There are some extraordinary cases like Travis Walton's, or of course like the Allagash guys. But beyond that, even if those cases didn't exist, why do people feel like they're having these experiences? Why are these experiences so similar? Are they an effect from the media? If that's the case, why do people want to have these experiences? Why does the mind create these experiences and have these media influence experiences? Although, especially with my talk that I'm going to do at the conference about strange alien cases, these are some cases, and just like Chris is talking about, these are some cases that predate the media imagery. So that would, you know, lead one to believe that it's not just the mind, you know, reproducing something that they've seen on television, that it would be some sort of separate phenomena. So, you know, these are all outstanding questions, are all interesting questions. And, you know, beyond like the couple of people that we're going to have at the conference, like the actual therapists that are trained therapists that are working on this, which is just a very small handful, you know, there should be a lot more therapists and studying this phenomena to figure out also how to help these people. Because many people, you know, Yvonne Smith, she's a PTSD therapist, and she says these people do, you know, have similar effects to PTSD or perhaps PTSD from their experiences, meaning that they believe they've experienced a traumatic event or a traumatic experience. And I have a degree in psychology, and I know people can experience PTSD without even having to have had a real experience. Even someone else's experience can cause trauma in someone's psyche. So it's all really important stuff to look at, and that's why I think the sociological aspect, not only that, you know, I do a talk about ETs in religion, so its effect on religion, its effect on society, you know, the belief in aliens and its effect on technology, even sci-fi, of course, has had a huge influence on science. People talk about that all the time. Scientists talk about that all the time. So I love the sociological aspect. So I think that's what's wonderful about what Jacques Vallée does and about what Chris does. So this is really fascinating. If you haven't read Wonders in the Sky, definitely get that book. Of course, we had Jacques on the show when the book came out, but definitely get that book. It's a really great book. And Chris has got me super excited about Return to Magonia. I mean, this is right down my alley. And Jacques Vallée did write the foreword for this book. And Jacques has told me, you know, a couple times, you really need to interview Chris. You really need to interview Chris. So I'm so excited to have interviewed Chris. And as you can tell, with me going on and on about all of this, I'm really excited about the topic and what Chris had to say. So really fun. So you know what else I'm excited about? I'm excited about meeting Jacques Vallée. So how cool is that? So that's going to be coming up here next week, like Martin and I were talking about. So we won't have a show for another couple weeks. So I apologize for that ahead of time, because I'm going to be busy with the conference. Not only are we going to be a week from now, we're going to be loading up the truck and hauling it out there and setting up the conference. We'll be running the conference all week. And by this time, in 2 weeks from now, I'm going to take the day off and I'm going to sleep most of the day, because, you know, we go all the way up until Sunday night. We pack up the truck and take everything down. So after 5 days of 6 days of this long show, we're not done. We have to take everything down and load it up and head out of town as soon as possible. So we're not headed out of. We're just headed from one side of town to the other, but still, it's a lot of work. So unfortunately, I won't have a show next week or the week after. I'm not even going to pretend like I might be able to pull it off, because I won't. But 3 weeks from now, we'll have a show, and we'll be back and we'll talk about the conference. hopefully some of you will be able to come out to the conference because that will be extraordinary. I've already heard from a few of you, and I know you'll be there. So I know I'm really busy, but do try to say hi. I really do love it. Even if I'm busy and I'm like, hey, thanks, you know, and I shake your hand or whatever. I mean, I really, really do appreciate it when you do come say hi. I'm just so happy that there are so many listeners to the show, and so many of you do enjoy the show. And even if you bug me about, hey, where's another show? Why isn't there a show? You know what? I love that because it just means that you're really enjoying what we're providing for you all. And we love providing this. We love providing the conference. And we love providing UFO, the Open Mind UFO Report. So, and we do have a new one out. So go to YouTube or to openminds.tv. And you'll see a new UFO reports. We talk about the CIA documents, a video sighting report from Roger Marsh, and then also John Greenwald, who's speaking at the conference because of, as we talked about, you know, I think on the last show, you know, these files that the government has supposedly lost. In fact, I'm going to put that story up on the Huffington Post here soon. You know, the government claiming they lost more UFO files. What is up with that? And kudos to John Greenwald for getting the government to talk about this and admit they've lost these files or claim that they've lost these files, right? What's going on, people? So, really exciting stuff. So go check out the UFO report. Otherwise, you can also get updates in your email. Now, the last few weeks, we've sent out weekly emails because of the conference and updating everybody on what's going to be going on there, but also updating you on website stuff and on when we have a new Open Mind UFO report. Otherwise, we only send out the emails on a bi-weekly basis, so just every other week. So go to openminds.tv. In the upper right, you'll see where you can register. Put your email address in there to receive the update. Also, if you go to ufocongress.com, you'll see there's a big section there, big blue section, dark blue, where you can put in your email. It says, stay up to date in this little red box, and it says, you know, put in your email there. So you can get on our email list so you can stay up to date on everything that's going on and all of our cool stories and everything. And it's a good way just so, you know, I know you guys get busy. At least once in a while, you'll get a reminder that, hey, there's a couple of radio shows you got to catch up on, or, you know, here's the latest UFO report, or some cool stories that we've posted, or maybe some interviews that we've gotten that are rare or hard to get, or stuff like that. So, yeah, so definitely keep up to date by getting on the email list. Otherwise, everything that we talked with Martin Willis about, you can find at openminds.tv. Of course, Martin Willis does podcast UFO, so thank Martin for joining us and check out his podcast. You'll also be able to meet him at the UFO Congress, so he's a lot of fun to meet. He's just a really nice guy. He's a good guy. I'm so happy that he's joining us with the show these days. But yeah, openminds.tv, you're going to find all of this information. If you want more about the UFO Congress, check out ufocongress.com. Keep an eye on the news. We're going to have Fox News. We're going to have MSN. We're going to have MSN's going to have a story up real soon here. So we're going to have a lot of national press covering the event. And of course, if you're in the Arizona area, we always have a ton of local news covering the event. So keep your eye open, or keep an eye open on our Facebook and stuff, because we'll be posting this stuff. And yeah, we're going to get, I think, quite a bit of national media attention. So I'm really excited about that. Usually they cover the topic or the conference in a very positive light. So hopefully they'll be doing that again this year. Although sometimes you get a couple in there that just want to kind of make fun. And what can you do? That's our world today. So we try our best to avoid that by giving them good data. And that's the best thing you can do, is just give them good information. Stuff that is strong and compelling and credible. And they love that stuff. So the media really does want to cover good stuff if you got it. But some of them do want to cover the silly stuff. And if you don't give them good stuff, they'll cover the silly. What else are they going to do? They need a story. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us again. Thank you to Caleb Hanks once again for the excellent open and close music. There's been a couple people to ask, what is that open and close music? That is Caleb Hanks. And if you go to the Open Minds Radio website, you'll see a link for him. The Clerk Chronicles is the website that he has where he hosts his music, and he puts his music up for free. It is awesome music. I agree with you people who have been asking. I love Caleb's music, and Caleb, Micah Hanks runs the Graylium Report. He's great. He does a great show. And Caleb is his brother. They're both very talented musicians. And yeah, Caleb Hanks has got great, and they're both hilarious. They're a lot of fun. They're really cool guys. But anyway, yeah, check out Caleb Hanks' music. Otherwise, thank you all so much for joining us. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Adios, muchachos.